All right, I guess we'll probably get started now, so we have our special session.
Yes, so, Chair of Newbury, I think we will...
Can you speak up?
Yes, he can hear us, so...
Yes, I'm here, I'm ready to go.
Where is he? He's in...
Brisbane.
Early morning for him.
That's right.
I will just push the button, so go ahead.
Okay, all right, so this will be one of the first slides, I think, for me to start. So let me just give I'll probably run about 15 minutes worth of slides, and then I'll hand over to Dirk. So what I want to do is state as simply as I possibly can what the problem actually is about gravity and quantum mechanics and decoherence. Then I will quickly review Roger Penrose's claim that superpositions of masses in different positions is inherently unstable and will undergo decoherence. A different formulation that leads to pretty much the same result by Laos-Diossi. And then finally, I will quickly give another approach to this that Jake Taylor and I were working on at 10ITP back in January and early February. So stop at any point. So there's Jake. Next slide. As you can see, I wanted to give some caveat there, but this view I'm giving today is pretty much a personal view, so Jake may disagree with some elements of it, but the overall thrust I think he would be happy with. So here's the basic problem. Let's suppose we have a single massive object in a coherent superposition of two positions, and I want to stress that word single. There's only one particle in this system. And if you just click again. So here's the basic idea. It could be on the left of x equals 0 at minus t, or it could be on the right of x equals 0 at plus t, and it's in a coherent superposition of those two possibilities. And stress, there's only a single particle in the system. So the question is, what is the gravitational field associated with that mass distribution? Next slide. There's a similar problem arises if, instead of just looking at the Newtonian version of the problem, you look at the general relativistic version, where the gravitational field is represented by the metric field, and that's determined by the stress energy tensor. All of that is perfectly classical, but next slide. If you were to try and quantize the source of the gravitational field, perhaps due to some massive scalar field, then you face a big problem, because on the right-hand side you have an operator appearing, and on the left-hand side you have just some classical differential terms. So basically you end up with differential equations which have operators appearing in them. And this is the fundamental problem, if you press the next button, of how to consistently combine classical and quantum dynamics, and I'll come back to that. So that's just a more, somewhat more sophisticated way of stating the same problem. Okay, next slide. So one way around this is to do what I refer to here, somewhat disparagingly, perhaps that's a little unfair, but I'll call it the semi-classical dodge, which is to say, okay, well, what we really mean by that superposition, we can take the mod squared and get the probability distribution for the particle, multiply that by the mass, and call that the mass density, and that is now obviously a double peak distribution. Next slide. You then solve for the gravitational potential in the usual way, just by putting that mass density into Laplace's equation here. But of course, we have to make sure that the mass density itself obeys some quantum mechanical evolution, because it is determined by that wave function psi of x. So we end up with a self-consistent Schrödinger equation, where that potential that's appearing there, Vx, depends implicitly upon the wave function itself. So this is highly nonlinear. This is sometimes called Schrödinger-Newton or Newton-Schrödinger. And as some of you may have already guessed, this is not really a valid Schrödinger equation at all. If you press the next button, you'll see that all sorts of terrible things go wrong. First of all, because it's nonlinear, the superposition principle will tend to fail. Probabilities don't stay positive. There's violations of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle that can result in all sorts of problems
Gerald, there's a question.
So actually, Gerald, this is Lynn. I have a question. So basically, when you look at the mass density, so the first line, so on the slides, is there any interference term in the mass density due to, for example, your percent x has basically a superposition of left and right?
That's right. Well, because I took them to be well separated in position, the position probability density won't show interference fringes. To see that, we would need to look at the momentum distribution, which would show the interference fringes. However, it would be relatively easy, instead of taking a superposition of masses at different positions, to take a superposition of a single mass at different positions, to take a superposition of a single mass with different momenta, then you would see interference fringes in this probability density side of x. But your question is well put, because there could be some very strange wave functions for Schrodinger cascades with all sorts of unusual interference features which would look like a very strange mass density. Furthermore, the fact that there's a nonlinear Schrodinger equation governing its evolution, that psi of x could develop all sorts of fine structures due to the nonlinear dynamics, which would lead to some pretty strange mass densities, including the fact that it could collapse on itself.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, all right, so let's move on to the next slide.
David had a question.
More questions.
Okay.
So, first of all,
why is this special to gravity? This argument about what the semi-classical is. I mean, this could be true for electrodynamics if you don't quantize the electromagnetic field.
That's correct. So,
there's not special to gravity.
There's only one feature that is special to gravity, which I'll come to in a minute, but that's the equivalence principle. Now, I should add, of course, that there may be a way to make sense of this semi-classical approximation in the main body theory, which is typically where nonlinear Schrodinger equations arise. For example, the Gross-Kudiewski equation for the semi-classical dynamics of a BDC is a perfectly well-defined object. But stressing here that I'm dealing with a single particle that's in a superposition of two positions.
No, but there are one second. Coming back to electrodynamics as an example which this treatment leads to paradoxes, the answer there is that this is the wrong treatment, and we know definitely well how to treat electrodynamics and point particles in a completely consistent quantum mechanical way.
Yeah.
So, what? I mean, this is just the wrong approach, period.
That's correct. I would agree. So, Yan-Bei Chen at Caltech has made some progress in interpreting these sorts of semi-classical equations as an explicitly many-body approach. So, I'm presenting this as a kind of straw man argument. And it is the wrong approach. That's true. But let me just... Are there any further questions?
Yes.
Well, David asked my question. Trying to agree, but I just add that we know how to do it in gravity, right? There's a source here with a certain amplitude, and there'll be a certain amplitude for the consequent field, the quantum field. Right? And the same is true for forces on the other side, and there will be an amplitude for a different quantum field. So we know.
Okay, I didn't actually hear the question, I'm sorry.
I'm agreeing with David. Maybe that's a concise summary, and we know how to do it furthermore by using quantum.
Okay. So
there's no maybe what you're saying, and I'm sure we all agree, is that it is inconsistent to not to quantize the field that responds to a source.
That's
in a quantum mechanical theory. So we quantize the electromagnetic field, and we must quantize the gravitational field or potential non-relativistic.
That's absolutely right. In the case of the electromagnetic field, we know what to do.
Sorry?
In the case of the electromagnetic field, we know what to do.
At this level, we know what to do in the case of the gravitational field, too. We don't run into any problems semi-classically. Without, we're not worried, you're not including loops and virtual particles and stuff. So at this level, we know what to do in the case of the gravitational field as well.
Okay.
That's what Jim was saying.
Yeah, let's take linearized gravity, for example. It's just essentially the same thing.
Okay, so So let me just summarize that. There is a way to make sense of a semi-classical treatment, but it's not the way I'm presenting here. So if we could just move on to the next slide then. So one of the things which I think goes wrong in thinking of this as a kind of distribution of mass is to, if you press the button again, please, is to ask, what would you do? Press the slide again. What would you do to determine which of the two possibilities actually obtained? So if you were to try to measure the position of this massive object M, the simplest thing to do would just be to use some test variables to try and map out the gravitational field. So you would basically fire a small test particle and look for its deflection by the gravitational field of this massive object. So essentially what we're trying to do is measure where the particle actually is by how it deflects some test or probe particle. So obviously it could either be deflected to the left or it could be deflected to the right. And the extent to which it's deflected is determined by the signal-to-noise ratio of the measurement. And that depends on how you prepare the test particle, how close it passes to the massive object. But either one way or the other, in each trial, it's either deflected to the left or it's deflected to the right. And of course, if I took an equal superposition, it would be a 50-50 outcome for those two possibilities. If you press the button again, you'll just see that's starting at the bottom. So are there any questions about that? I think that's pretty straightforward.
Well, the experiment has actually been done and written up by Page and Gaelker way, way back. They used bowling balls in a laboratory Geiger counter to determine what the superposition was, and checked whether they had a Cavendish type apparatus to check whether the deflection went one way or the other.
If someone could just summarize the question for me.
The experiment has been done by Page and Gaelker a long time ago in the 70s.
Good. So if we press the next slide again.
It's right here. Putting a mass in a superposition of positions.
So let's suppose you did actually have a true double-peak mass distribution. So now we actually have two particles situated on either side of the origin. So the mass distribution is double-peaked. Now, of course, if you send a perfectly symmetric probe through the system, you see no deflection at all under ideal circumstances. So if you press the button again. So in each trial, the particle is never deflected. Now, if you had a many-body system, of course, it would be hard. I mean, if there was more than one mass involved in the superposition, then it's not so easy to make this distinction. Okay, next slide. So as I stressed, this is really a measurement of the center of mass position of the particle, and as you point out, it's already been done. So we press the button again. And of course, doing this experiment necessarily decoheres the superposition insofar as it is a good measurement. That is to say, if the signal-to-noise ratio is greater than 1, the superposition will decohere. That is, the off-diagonal coherence in the position basis will decay very rapidly. And when you actually do a simple-minded calculation, you will discover that the rate at which the coherence is suppressed is exponential in a factor that's virtually identical to the Penrose-DLC decoherence factor that you get. Okay, next slide. Now, of course, you don't have to use test particles. You could use clocks if you wish, because for the gravitational field, it basically affects everything one way or another, so that you could, for example, use a gravitational redshift. So you put a clock just to the right of x equals b, and then try and look for a difference in the gravitational redshift of clocks, depending on whether the particle is on the left or the right of the origin. Now, from one trial to the next, of course, it will fluctuate because it's a superposition, so sometimes it'll be found on the left, sometimes it'll be found on the right. So from the point of view of the clock, if you press the button again, if you look at that ensemble of measurements, it will appear as fluctuations in the clock frequency over many, many repetitions of the experiment. So that will also be the superposition, but interestingly now, the superposition will appear as fluctuations in this clock frequency, and which would look it would look very much like some sort of extra line width or some sort of phase diffusion in the clock that you were using to try and determine the relative position of the particle. Okay. Next button. So because of this curious way in which you can use just about anything to distinguish whether the particle's on the left or the right, and that all these different measurement scenarios lead to a suppression of coherence, just as you would expect if you make a good measurement, and they all lead to decoherence in pretty much the same form, it looks like, you know, you would be tempted just to attribute that directly to the gravitational field itself. So let me just pause there and ask if there's any questions.
The last sentence I don't see.
Okay.
I mean, the way I would say this is that what is fluctuating is the vector. It's no surprise that clock frequencies fluctuate if G00 fluctuates.
That's right.
So exactly. It's not that the gravity is decoherent, curved space-time is decoherent, curved space-time is fluctuating.
Okay.
And yeah, its coherence can be decohered as well by whatever you're coupling the clock to.
That's correct.
So, but you go along this last sentence, I don't see that is implied by it. And the last sentence is the important point, I gather.
Okay, so this leads me on to the next slide. The reason that sentence is there is simply to give me a segue to the next slide, which is, I want to now just quickly state, this is a thorny business, but let me just try to state as quickly as possible what Roger Penrose says about the intrinsic instability of quantum coherence when gravitational fields are significant. So he has an argument which shows that the rate of decoherence for two mass distributions, rho and rho prime. So we're thinking again of a single particle in the superposition of two different positions, or perhaps more than one particle, some mass distribution, rho and rho prime, which ultimately result in some coherent superposition. Then the decoherence rate that he establishes to some fairly relevant arguments is given by that double integral there. So the rate of decoherence is h bar on delta, so that delta represents something like an energy uncertainty, and then using the energy time uncertainty principle, he was led to this this rate of decoherence. So that just summarizes his argument in one line, which is not really doing justice. I don't know whether Dirk will come back to this or not, but I just wanted to get that expression up there. To contrast it with Yossi's expression a little bit later, but I just want to return to another approach to this problem. So if you press the next slide, and that's this problem of consistently combining quantum and classical dynamics. So this is a really old problem. So if you look at it in a very simple form, it's got nothing to do with gravity. Just imagine we have two harmonic oscillators, one of which is quantized and the other which is not quantized. And we want to drive the quantum oscillator with the oscillating position of the classical oscillator. So the classical oscillator is represented with these uppercase p's and q's, they're the canonical variables. So you write down the Heisenberg equations of motion for the quantum dynamics, and there's nothing strange about that, because it's quite possible to put a classical time-dependent modulation into that second term there for the momentum. But if you naively write down Hamilton's equations for that Hamiltonian, you see that it doesn't make a lot of sense, because again, we have this operator appearing on the right-hand side in the very last equation. Mm-hmm. One way to try and make sense of this is to say, oh, well, what we actually mean is that x there is really a stochastic random variable of some sort, so there are quantum fluctuations in it, and we need to consistently treat those quantum fluctuations. But it's very easy to end up with all sorts of inconsistencies in pursuing that approach, because basically it's saying that quantum mechanics is some sort of local beam variable theory. So can't get too far with that. Many people have tried, if you press the button again, to try and make some sense of this quantum classical hybrid dynamics, going back to Anderson in 1995, and probably much earlier. These are just the ones I put here because I want to refer to them a little bit later. Jonathan Halliwell had an approach to this in the late 90s, which is very similar to the results I'll present in a few minutes. Asha Perez and Danny Turner looked at it, and most recently, Leos Diossi looked at it again, and it's Diossi's approach I want to turn to next. So if you press the button again. So in Diossi's approach, he said, okay, what we will do is we will parameterize the quantum density operator by the classical canonical coordinates of this other classical system. And then the quantum density operator will be obtained by integrating over the classical variables, while the classical phase-space probability density will be given by tracing over the quantum phase-space density. He then wrote down, following an example of this kind of evolution equation, which involves both a quantum commutator and a symmetrized Poisson bracket, which he called the Alexandrov bracket, and you quickly discovered that this doesn't preserve positivity of density operators in general. So this is not consistent. Next slide. His approach to fixing it was to look at the interaction between the quantum and classical degrees of freedom, which is just QQ, just position-position interaction, and add noise to both the quantum and classical variables. So he added some fluctuating fields to some fluctuating quantum mechanical degree of freedom to the quantum degree of freedom, and a fluctuating classical degree of freedom to the classical Q. It defined in terms of Gaussian white noise processes, so it's two diffusion constants that define the noise. Then if you average over the noise, you get a master, or something that looks like a master equation for this hybrid object. But now it explicitly includes two terms that lead to decoherence in the position basis for the quantum system, and simultaneously a momentum diffusion process for the classical system. And he shows that the evolution will remain positive so long as the product of those two noise terms is bounded below by something that depends on Planck's constant squared. So there is a way to try to make sense of this hybrid dynamics by adding noise to both the quantum and the classical. Adding noise to the classical may seem innocuous enough, but adding noise to the quantum case, as you can see, leads directly to a decoherence in the position basis. So he used this, he now looked at the case of gravitational interactions between particles, if you press the button again. So he then applied this to calculate a rate of decoherence in the case of gravitational interactions, and he gets a form for the decoherence rate that is very similar to Penrose. In fact, it's functionally equivalent to Penrose, where Penrose had a product of the sum and difference of the densities. This one just has the product of the density. So these are the same decoherence rates. So let me just pause there. That's the best I can do in the time available to quickly present the Penrose result and the Diossi result. Are there any questions on that? If not, let's press the next button. So all this is well and good, but in the absence of any experiment, it's all a bit empty. So what I want to do now is just quickly suggest, and I think Kurt's going to pick this up a little bit more as an experiment, where we try and actually measure the gravitational interactions between two degrees of freedom using an optomechanical system.
Sorry, Gareth?
Yes?
So, there's something I never understood, I must say. What the argument behind, you gave an argument following Penrose, which derives the same formula for the decoherence time, right?
Right. Yes.
Which was based on a totally ad hoc assumption of adding a noise term to the time evolution of density.
Yeah.
What? Now, Penrose, however, claimed not to do anything so ad hoc. What was his argument, essentially?
Okay, I'm probably not a very good person to present it.
So, but are you saying that?
One way to think about it is that a superposition of two mass distributions will lead to fluctuations in the direction of time. It leads to fluctuations in G0 in the metric field, and that will appear as something like phase fluctuations in the quantum mechanical evolution of the superposition. of two states. So when you superpose the two states, you no longer have an energy eigenstate for the system, so that it will evolve in time, and fluctuations in the metric field resulting from the quantum superposition state leads to decoherence due to fluctuations in the temporal evolution of that superposition state. Now, it's probably not a very good way to summarize it. I must admit, I don't fully understand it myself. Perhaps we could come back to this a little bit later if someone there has a better understanding of what's going on. But it was a combination of this argument about the fact that the superposition state that you get is not an energy eigenstate for the gravitational field, and that leads to fluctuations which will appear as deep events. Okay, so came back to this experiment.
That explains to me why the Penrose's formula had a kind of estimate of the energy between these two lumps, right?
Yeah, it's a kind of self energy, I guess, or a difference in self energy between the two mass distributions.
Right. But it doesn't still hasn't explained this, why that causes decoherence. I mean, you could certainly have, you don't get decoherence just by having
non-coherence. Yeah, I agree. Well, it all comes down to how one, when you go looking for decoherence, it usually manifests itself as some uncontrolled fluctuation from one trial to the next. So that when you average the data...
With an environment, with some part of it.
That being a standard argument. So that's why I tried to start off by using an actual probe to measure the position of the particles. There you find them as the probe particle itself. Well, Penrose's argument is not entirely clear what the environment is.
But it sounds like the second derivation you gave suggests that Penrose, whatever's argument was sneaking in a hidden ad hoc assumption.
Yes, I worry about that myself. I worry about that a lot. But I can't put my finger on precisely what that is. It may be circular, I'm not sure. But it's a pretty subtle argument. It's based, as I said, on the Pillars principle and the structure option in the Kelly vector field for the two superpositions.
I will try to say a little bit more about it later on.
Okay, good. I'll also leave it to you to talk about the mechanics, so let me just quickly move on. Next slide. So let's take a much simpler problem. Let's just take two oscillators, gravitationally coupled. So these are two pendulums with small deviations from the vertical, so that I can think of the simple harmonic oscillators. It's pretty straightforward if you press the button to describe this quantum mechanically. Very simple. Two harmonic oscillators, 2 degrees of freedom. The coupling between them is XX, and coupling constant K is GM, big M, little m on dq, where D is, but D is the distance between the center mass of these two masses. So that's essentially the gradient of the potential that's coming in. The gradient of the force. So, one could now just turn ahead and look for example, you could look for normal mode splitting of these two oscillators and some optomechanical transducer for the oscillators. You can try and pick that up in the optics. That would be one way to go. If you press the button, we'll now go on to another way to think about this, which leads directly to the Ossie's result. And it came up with Jake Taylor's question at the talk he gave back at KITP, and that was, could we think about gravity as being communicated through a classical measurement channel? So I decided just to push that through and see what would happen. Press the button again, I don't really have a clear way to explain this. It's really a wild conjecture at the moment. But the basic idea is that the interaction between these two masses when mediated by gravity takes place as if classical bits, something is being measured on the first object. Classical information is then transmitted to the second object, which tells it how to move, and vice versa, of course. But I'll just run the argument in one direction to begin with. So this is all pretty crazy, but if you just bear with me for a minute, let's just see what happens. So next slide. So when you formulate it this way, it's identical to a feed-forward control scheme that we're accustomed to dealing with in quantum optics, right? Howard Weisman wrote it as many years ago. We imagine that there is some continuous weight measurement of the position of the large mass, and that measurement result forms some sort of current, which is then used to drive the small mass. Press the button again. That measurement current is a classical stochastic process, but it's conditioned on the quantum mechanical position of the large mass. So we see in there that there is a conditional mean value of the position of the large mass appearing. But it's a highly nonlinear object conditioned on all previous measurement results. It's history dependent. It's consistent on the history of measurement records. And we see a white noise term there, which you'll notice goes to zero as gamma goes to infinity. So gamma is essentially the rate at which information is acquired or transferred. Gamma is how strong the measurement is. As gamma goes to infinity, the measurement is really good, and the signal-to-noise ratio becomes better and better. That is the signal part. That first conditional moment dominates the current, and the noise is a very small component on the current. So if you press the button again, okay, I've already emphasized that that mean value sitting there looks like some sort of semi-classical approximation, but in fact it is not. It's a conditional mean value of the state of the system conditioned on all previous measurement records. So something like this comes up in Jonathan Powell's approach, and he got to it using the consistent histories formulation. Okay, so let's just move on. It begins to look, press the button again, it begins to look semi-classical optical predictions. If you press the button again, what we'll do now is average over all possible measurement records, and I'll choose a particular size for the feed-forward control. In fact, I'll set the feed-forward control parameter equal to this gravitational coupling constant K. And then if you press the button again, you'll see the resulting master equation that you get when you average over the noise. You see there's this curious term which corresponds to the systematic effect of the feed-forward. It almost looks Hamiltonian, but it's not quite. You'll notice the way x rho plus rho x comes in, it's kind of symmetrized, and that's extremely reminiscent of the Alexander bracket that we also wrote down. But here it naturally arises because of the way in which we're measuring the large mass and feeding it forward to the small mass. However, for the first order moments, that will be indistinguishable from our Hamiltonian dynamic between these two masses. It's the third term, at rate gamma, is the effect of the measurement on the large mass, and you see that it goes with rate gamma, so a very good measurement, as I said, is gamma large, which leads to rapid decoherence in the ionic states of X for the large mass. And now we pick up what I call the sort of feedback fluctuation term. This is the effect of the feed forward onto the smaller mass, and you see that it leads to an equivalent decoherence in position for the smaller mass. So this argument could be run the other way, of course. It's not necessary, I don't have to run it from the large mass to the small mass, it should be entirely symmetric. So if this is going to be consistent, you really should equate the two decoherence rates in front of the third and the fourth term. Well, I haven't put this in there, but if you do that, you find that the big decoherence rate gamma is basically K, that gravitational coupling constant. And then if you press the button again, that is precisely the decoherence rate that D'Ossi's hybrid dynamics would predict in this case. So here we're getting that consistent hybrid dynamics emerging as a kind of measurement and feed forward process, treating the gravitational interaction as a purely classical channel. If you press the button again, I emphasize that D'Ossi's formulation gives pretty much the same result as Penrose, so these things will all get the same numerical value. Well, the decoherence rate, which I hasten to add, is rather large. That is, the time on which it takes to collapse is pretty fast. So that's where I'll finish and hand over to Bill.
Any further questions? Yeah, Jim.
There is a long history of people seeking modifications somewhat to quantum mechanics, somewhat like this, by starting with the result of Feynman and Vernon in the 70s, where you integrate out a bath and you wind up with a path integral that has what's called the influence phase and so forth in it, which modifies the classical dynamics by contributing noise and also causes, in general, decoherence. And then saying, well, you didn't need the path. Maybe these terms are just in the relevant path integral anyway, some kind of fundamental noise and fundamental theories. Is this approach, can this approach be cast into these terms, or is that something, is it something different?
Okay. You could actually try and do this feed-forward process in the lab. You could use an optical mechanical transducer to do a highly active measurement of the position of a large mass, and then use that measurement result to modulate a driving force on the smaller mass. So in one sense, this equation I've written here could actually describe a real experiment. But the other way to think of it, which is what you're suggesting, is to regard it as in some sense fundamental. You would have to come up with some argument which says that gravitational interactions are mediated by classical channels. And I don't know of any argument along those lines.
Maybe a simpler way of putting my question is, there's been a certain amount of work by Stamp, and unrecently, which they call, gravitational decoherence. Is this for the uninitiated? Do we have to read their papers once we've discussed yours?
Yes, no, everything. I've done a lot of work. I mean, I've worked myself on this idea of intrinsic decoherence, just postulating that at some fundamental level there is an intrinsic decoherence mechanism. And those equations come out pretty much the same as I've written down here. That approach that I use stems from Benignan Pulley's approach to sort of relational time in quantum mechanics. And if you push that through seriously, you get a kind of fundamental decoherence and intrinsic decoherence. So for this particular case, will look pretty much like those two double commutator terms that I've written down.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so then we'll move on. So I didn't quite know what I was supposed to present. Definitely some on the experimental side, but since I work a little bit with Roger Penrose, I think I have a little bit of a different view on his ideas, so I will present some of that. And as an experimentalist, let's set the stage with some fictional things. But in optics, we always use our beam splitter, the 50-50 beam splitter, and quantum superpositions, we come in with a single photon.
Come in with a single photon, and on the 50-50 beam splitter, we create a superposition in this way. Now, experimentally, to prove that you have a superposition, obviously you do an interference experiment, and you design your setup such that you get actually a unique outcome. So it's not quantum indeterminism or probabilities, you design an interference experiment so that you get a unique answer. And that is our proof that we have a superposition. Okay. So this is just a basic idea how you go about proving the existence of two paths that live simultaneously, so to speak. And if you insist on asking a question, which path does your photon take, then you have to design an experiment where you put two detectors, and then we find out that one clicks and we cannot say which one is going to click. Okay, now the quantum wave function can be interpreted in different ways, and one way is by Bohr, where we shouldn't say that the wave function contains more than just the information we have of the system. It's not describing the system itself. It describes our knowledge that we gain from the system. So that's one way of looking at things. Another way of looking at things is by using quantum entanglement. We know we can create entangled states. This is a state of two photons where this one is H, this one is V, and the other way around. And we can get correlations that cannot be understood classically. Now, everything is probably entangled in the world. So it's we do our best in an experiment to create controlled entanglement, but entanglement is everywhere. All interactions produce entanglement. So if we now have a quantum system and we try to do a measurement on it, we typically do something like this. We take different quantum states and we entangle them with a certain outcome of your measuring device. So system one could be your quantum system, system two would be your measuring device. And in that way, we can clearly understand that interference effects will no longer be possible to observe. Because if one of your entangled systems is so large that the number of degrees of freedom is so large that you cannot do an interference experiment anymore, you cannot recombine the two different states, then obviously you will not see any interference anymore, and you will not be able to prove that there was a superposition. So these ideas, environment-induced decoherence, and there are different models based on coupling of your quantum system to a bath of harmonic oscillators or to a spin two or multi-level systems, like Philip Stemple has done. So those models perfectly explain how a quantum superposition, when coupled to a macroscopic device, will behave in a classical way. We can only predict probabilities for outcomes. But the whole dynamics that is taking place still allows for the superpositions to persist. So if I say my two detectors, they form the environment. So I have a photon cone here that becomes entangled with this detector clicking, or the photon cone here, then it becomes entangled with this detector clicking. So this state simply would go over in this state, but I will never be able to prove that this state is there because I cannot do an interference experiment anymore, because the number of degrees of freedom here and there are so large that I cannot design, at least with current technology and experiments, that will prove that this superposition is there. And again, by this argument, by saying this is my environment, I perfectly get the probabilistic outcomes from quantum mechanics. Of course, I could say, well, actually, my experiment contains all this, and with future technology, I will be able to combine these readings. For example, if instead of this detector, I take some small amount of atoms that would store the photon and here, and then I can do certain measurements on these atoms so that I erase the information which atoms has stored the photon, and then I can prove that there was a superposition of the two detections. Yeah. So this is just very difficult to do, but with environment-induced decoherence, you would still argue this way. And of course, you can extend it further. You could also say that the observer becomes entangled and so forth. And of course, if you really believe in that, this is Lev Vitamin. A long time ago, I met him on a bus and he was rather confused and irritated because he was applying for a patent and he just couldn't get it through. And he said, it's just such a nice idea and I don't understand why they don't want to go for it. And his idea was just take your beam splitter, two single photon detectors, and a single photon source. If you have to make a difficult decision in life, just ask the watch what to do. And that was the first time for me that I really got this notion of this is someone who lives in the who believes in the many worlds. And in fact, this device is available today. There's a company where you can buy your cell phone, you can ask a random outcome, and they do a single photon experiment and send you the outcome. It's a commercial product. It costs $1, you'll get this.
Who's the poor graduate student doing
there? No, it's all automated. It's a Swiss company. It's working. But this makes perfectly sense from quantum entanglement with the environment. And it also makes sense from a bit bigger picture. Who is doing measurements on the universe? Maybe we should accept that the universe is just one large quantum system and all the correlations are still there. And in that sense, it's just a matter of choosing what is your experiment you're interested in and what is your environment. Or basically, you say, I'm limited in extracting the coherences from my larger system, so that's where I put my boundary from what is quantum and what is classical. Okay, so if you don't like this, then there are all these models of why large superpositions would not be able to survive. And then you take your quantum mechanical system, you pick any nonlinearity you like, because nonlinearities tends to focus the wave. So nonlinearities in optics, they tend to focus the waves. So you get confinement of your wave, and then you add a little bit of noise to push it to one or the other output. And that's exactly what DOC's type of ideas are. You add a little bit of nonlinearity, whatever you like, and then you add a little bit of noise, and then this wave function evolves, it contracts to one, and next time the noise will make it contract to the other. So that's okay, that's okay. But to me, that is all, or let's say to Roger Penrose, that is all rather superficial. So let's go to some of the arguments by Roger Penrose. And this is the argument that is that we have discussed before, gravitation-induced quantum state production. But in that paper, there's actually reference to other things. And I think I should say a few words on that. I just like it very much, and I think there are some very deep insights to be gained. So Roger Penrose likes to think in the big picture, so let's think as big as we can. I know I should update this graph a little bit. But here we are, and it's astonishing how much we've learned about the past. And we sort of know quite certain that at the beginning, everything was massless. Okay, we'll come back to that. Then I'd like to show this little graph that...
Sorry, everything we... inflaton, whatever control of inflation was not massless. Any modeling of inflation.
I, as far as I've understood, you started with massless particles, they slowly evolved to more massive particles, massive, more massive, massive, massive.
That's what drives inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely has a scale. And it's often modeled by Andre Linde as a massive scalar field. Other people put another, So there's certainly a scale.
Okay.
It's not conformal invariant.
Okay, well, I need the conformal invariant. That's what Penrose goes on and on about, and it's beautiful. But, yeah, okay, that's an important point. Yeah? Okay, so everyone knows what happened at this moment, and my claim is that's why we have now an explosion in evolution on Earth.
Civil war.
Well, come on. You must do better than that. Anyone?
A condom was invented?
1861. Sir?
That was early.
Sorry. Okay.
Krakatoa or
something? Okay, all right.
Maxwell.
Okay, so he basically added one term to a set of equations that were known. In principle, it was nice, this set of equations, but that wasn't the big surprise. The surprise was that if you take the sources away, you still have a set of equations that have a very special solution. So that must have been such a revolution for him to just suddenly realize he had the description of light in his hand. And from that, it didn't take long to develop theory of relativity. And in fact, it also played a major role in the development of quantum theory. And it all was about black body radiation and how to describe this. And this is a perfect, almost perfect picture of the early universe. It's described perfectly with the black body radiation, which seems to say that the early state of the universe was a state of maximum entropy, at least from the massless field point of view. Light also gave direct input to the gauge theory, and that model was then adapted to more elaborate gauge theories. Okay, so where twister theory comes in is by putting light, or more general meshless fields and conformal symmetries at the highest level, you try to combine these things. So this is your starting point. And I think we haven't come a long way yet in grasping the consequences from of this approach. So let me say a few words why this twister approach is so interesting. So first of all, we call it a spinor theory. If you take a space-time point, then you can write it down like this, where you recognize the four Pauli matrices. The determinant is equal to the four interval. So any element, any matrix transformation of SL2C, the norm-preserving matrix transformations of this, will give you a Lorentz transformation. But because of this construction, it's a 2-to-1 isomorphism. And if you, for example, write down a Lorentz boost in this way, then you need this element, and the rotation through psi, you need this element. And what is very pretty about this approach is that you can only do this if you have one space, or one time in three space dimensions. And somehow there seems to be spinor statistics coming in, but not yet if we look at general space-time points. It becomes interesting if you look at those space-time points which represent the light cone. So if the four interval is zero, then this way of describing can be reduced to actually the information in a single complex component object, which we call a spinor. So a single spinor in this way can represent all the light lighting, all the directions on the light cone. And this spinor is determined up to a phase, so because the phase falls out in this construction. And if you now say this spinor itself is more fundamental than points on the light cone, then you can have SL2C acting directly on the spinor itself. And you will get a minus sign if you have a rotation over 2 pi. Okay, now this is all about the Lorentz group, but we know that Maxwell's equations and Maxwell's field equations are invariant under a larger group, the 15-dimensional conformal group. So we have to extend this construction to objects that can not only capture the Lorentz group, but also the full conformal group. And just an example of a conformal transformation of a plane to a disk, you just locally have angles staying the same. And another typical example is stereographic projection of a plane onto a sphere, right? So if you have a conformal invariant theory, then if it lives on this plane, the same theory applies to this sphere. And you have a one-to-one mapping where the point here represents infinity in all directions. Okay, so a twister is an extension of the idea of a spinor in relation to the Lorentz group. It now you take a combination of two spinors and you have something that represents meshless fields that are invariant under all conformal transformations. So so a spinor, a single spinor, can also be seen as a representation of the four momentum and the the angular six momentum of massless particles. Okay. All right, so what Penrose tries to do is describe physics in twister language, and then at the secondary level, you can go back to Minkowski phase and see what your physics in twister space looks like in Minkowski space. And recently, with several students also in the room, we've been looking at some of the elementary solutions of meshless field equations, like the Maxwell equations and the linearized Einstein equations. You take the simplest solutions as obtained in twister theory, and then you look how they look like in Minkowski space. You get some very intriguing structures of linked field lines. This is for the EMB fields of electromagnetism, and similar structures hold for gravitational radiation. but I don't want to go into that here. So what can we learn from twisted theory? That space-time seems to be a secondary concept. It somehow, because of the spinor structure, has a natural three space, one time coordinate structure. At the spinor level.
I mean, twisters are actually nicer than two signature.
Twisters are nicer in 2-2 signature. Instead of
3-1.
Okay, this statement applies to the and single spinor. That you say if you combine two spinors?
No, no, no. If the signature of space-time is 2-2, there's also a twister space. Mm-hmm. Reality constraints are simpler.
That's even simpler, okay.
Actually nicer than 3-1. Okay. So I don't think it explains 3-1. Should start from that.
Okay. All right, that's a good one. Somehow you are dealing with objects that, so the spinors, you naturally get solutions of spin a half, spin one, spin three half, spin two in a very beautiful way. So that's rolling out of this.
It sort of could have been used to develop sort of super symmetry before, but couldn't.
Yes, there's one student is actually looking into that, yes. There seem to be also intrinsic quantum mechanical properties, and it turns out if you look for holomorphic twister functions, which are the most natural functions, you automatically satisfy quantization rules. But that's also not something to go in here. Then the whole construction is really geared around the conformal structure. Let's now move to this conformal argument. So in this paper, wave function collapse as a real gravitational effect. That's the paper where this model is that Gerard explained. And I should say that Penrose never used the word decoherence. He uses the word collapse. He doesn't have a decoherence mechanism. He doesn't even have a mechanism why it would go one way or the other. That's, again, those models require some nonlinearity so that the wave function has a natural tendency to focus, and then some extra noise will push an equal superposition to one side or the other. And this noise, if it's random, one time it goes to one way, one time it goes to the other. In Penrose's arguments, it just says something is wrong. It doesn't give a solution how it's resolved. It just says something is wrong, and it gives a time scale for that. That's all there is to that model. And in this paper, there is this footnote, and that was his original motivation for looking at this problem. And I probably still don't understand this statement, but there's also other strong evidence that nature's own choice of quantization procedure for general relativity must be fundamentally non-standard. This evidence is to be found in the gross time asymmetry that occurs in the structural space-time singularities. So I had a few times the opportunity to ask him what he meant with that, and the closest I can come in reproducing the arguments is still that he's very keen on the idea that we start out with conformal symmetry with meshless fields, and both at the beginning of the universe and at the end, there seems to be reasonable evidence that all mass will come together in a few very large black holes that will evaporate, and finally we will have predominantly massless fields. And then he likes to argue that if you have massless fields going out to infinity, that is the same. They could cross this point at infinity and come back at minus infinity towards you. So he tries to have a cyclic argument where the final state is conformally connected to the initial state. And if you go along with this line of thought, then there is some questions about entropy. First of all, from the radiation point of view, the early universe seemed to be in a maximum entropy state from the radiation point of view. So what is the answer of thermodynamics? Why do we get an increase of entropy from the beginning of the universe on? What Penrose argues is that from a gravitational point of view, the early universe is a very uniform energy distribution. And through the formation of massive particles and clusters of particles, you will actually get entropy in the gravitational degree of freedom. So initially, the massless fields are associated to gauge fields. They are different theories. And here, by the formation of lumps of energy clusters, you might form the notion of increase of entropy, and that's increase of entropy associated to massive particles. And I'd like to know more about this, so if people can give comments later on, that would be great. The question is, how can we come back to a state that was similar to the initial state? So the entropy that is gained by the formation of mass, and is that entropy, can that be undone in some process? And there he suggests that maybe when masses come together, there is a reduction of the phase space.
Black holes have maximal entropy. Theorems, mm-hmm. classic measure, entropy only increases proportion to the area of the black hole, which only increases according to Penrose's own theory.
Mm-hmm. So you say there's.
I don't understand.
So.
I mean, this whole argument rests on an attempt to construct a cyclic universe and to figure out why there's an arrow of time in a cyclic universe.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
My God.
Yeah. That
leads to gravitational
decoherence. That is his motivation to look for gravitational decoherence.
Quite a roundabout argument.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And again, you would have.
So if I wanted to give up a cyclic universe in this way, conformally cyclic universe, then.
I think. Everything is very much geared towards the fact that conformal symmetry is such a beautiful concept, and it seems to relate, well, you tell me otherwise, to the beginning of the universe and maybe to the end of the universe.
I mean, Penrose did all this before we discovered the cosmological concept, which introduces another scale.
Okay, I'm just trying to argue why he was so very keen on a state reduction scheme, and this is the statement that is in that particular paper. There's this footnote, and he goes back to that. Okay, so then in the end you extract from it what you like, and then he goes back to a much more down-to-earth way of formulating his idea that there should be a state reduction associated to measurements to massive objects being in superposition states. And that's what Jared Milburn went over, so I...
are you saying that measurement taken as interpreted as collapse of the wave function,
so
decreases entropy?
The von Neumann entropy of a quantum system is reduced by performing a projection measurement. And there is an analogy to a similar mechanism that might be a real physical mechanism. Yes. It's very far-fetched. But what I did show is that if you take these conformal theories very serious, you will see that you have your gauge theories, and then something else has to happen when masses come into play. And the role of gravitational forces is very, very different in that picture than these other forces. And okay, that's so it's time to get down to Earth. And Penrose comes up with some predictions of what goes wrong if you try to put a massive object in a superposition. And he gives, towards experimentalists, clear calculations to do which systems could be put in superpositions and how long are those superpositions allowed to persist. And so we sat down and we started to do some calculations. Initially, he was thinking of an experiment with satellites. So you have a mirror floating out in space. You bounce off a UV photon that is part of an interferometer. And then this object will move because of the momentum impact. And then you have a very long delay line. So by the time it moves back exactly at the right time, you stop it again, and the photon comes back. Then it interferes with the other arm. And if this object, if the photon took this path, the mirror stays at rest. If the photon took this path, the mirror would have moved. And you basically have an entangled state of this tiny object with a large object. And if the reduction of the wave function or the collapse of the wave function should take place of this superposition of being at rest and moving, then once the photon comes back, it will not interfere anymore with itself. So that was his idea. And then I said, okay, let's see if we can design something with high quality cavities, with tiny mirrors, that might be done in a lab on Earth. And if you put... Yes. So you have an explicit calculation to do, and if you put in masses, if you take a tiny cube of material from which you can make a mirror, you take certain resonator arms with certain frequencies, you have a high enough quality of your cavity that the photons bounces around enough so that there is more than the ground state size of this mechanical resonator displacement as a result of the momentum impact, you can actually put this mirror in a superposition of moving or not moving. And so the calculations, well, first of all, there's a problem in doing the actual calculation, because what is the mass and what is the mass distribution of a piece of material? And if you think of the mass as point masses, then this argument by Penrose would give an infinite amount of, or a huge amount of gravitational self-energy by the tiniest displacement, because you have huge gravitational fields, so it cannot be point particles. So you have the problem that not only are you doing something controversial in this part of the theory, you're also doing something controversial in your calculation of the effect. So what mass are you going to put in? What mass distribution? Well, we know that the atom has definitely a small nucleus, and then the nucleus seem to be filled out with gluons, and there it seems actually that you have a fairly homogeneous mass energy distribution. So you might take the size of the nucleus or something slightly smaller as a fair estimate of the mass distribution or the energy distribution in a nucleus. And so if you take 10 to the minus 15 as the size of your nucleus in your calculation, or another approach is you might want to take the ground state wave vector of the full object as the relevant size. And there's no clear reason.
So that size is A in your formula?
That's the size is A, and delta X is your displacement. And you assume that your displacement is going to be larger than this A. And so if we take this size and we take our typical mirror size, which is basically the diameter of a hair, you will come to a decoherence time or a collapse time of about 1 millisecond. If we take the size of the ground state wave packet, it will more be of the order of a second. And if you do the same calculation, for example, for the C60 molecule experiments done by Marcus Arndt in Vienna, Zeininger. Then actually the superpositions are allowed to exist for 10 to the 10 seconds. So you really have to scale this up enormously before you come in the regime that you might conceive an experiment. Okay. So these estimates we published and we had discussions with Roger Penrose on these things. And this is basically the drawing of the setup. Here's your tiny mirror, part of a high quality cavity. This is your other cavity. You come in with a single photon, you put it in the superposition, and then if the photon is here, the mirror stays at rest. If the photon is here, the mirror will be displaced by more than the quantum ground state. And then, depending on the time when the photon leaks out, if it's entangled, if the position of the mirror is distinguishable from the position at rest, then the photon should not be able to interfere with itself. So you should see that the interference disappears. But after, if the photon is stored for one period of motion of the cantilever, then the information is erased that the photon was here, and you should get interference back. So this setup looks very similar to LIGO indeed, where we have larger mirrors. And in fact, there's a serious push towards using LIGO for a test of this coherence, or at least for a test of macroscopic coherences. So they try to get time for a certain amount of time, maybe a month, to perform similar experiments in LIGO. And in fact, right now, there are very serious efforts to piggyback on LISA, whenever it will happen, to do this type of experiments on there as well, and test satellites with the optics for single photon sources, high quality optics, are being built right now. Okay, I should wrap up quickly. So this is again the sketch of the system. This is our tiny mirror. The Hamiltonian is really, the physics, the mathematics, the quantum mechanics is very straightforward. You have photons in your cavity, you have phonons in your mechanical mode, and you have the position of the mechanical system coupled to the number of photons. And there's just very recently, there's a very extensive review, which I can recommend for everyone who's interested in this type of experiments. It really gives a very good overview of the field. So what we've done in this initial paper, as the coherence, as an input state of the mirror, we start with a coherent state. So you have a phonon coherent state of this mirror. Your initial state is a photon in arm A. It's a photon in arm B and no photon in arm A, or the opposite. And this is the mirror state. And then due to the interaction, we get an entangled state of the mirror with the photon. And this entangled state will disappear after one period of oscillation. So what you hope to see eventually is that the interference of the photon will decay and will revive after one period of oscillation. Now, if your system, the mechanical system, is not in the ground state, you start with a superposition of phonon states. And the interaction with this photon, with this superposition, will give all kind of different phases. So actually, you will quickly see all your interference disappear. And then there will be some revival if all these modes coherently come back. So it will be extremely hard if you already start with such a complex state. So if you could go to the quantum ground state or close to the quantum ground state, that would be a huge advantage for performing such experiments. Okay. So you can calculate the requirements for enough momentum transfer, and we, for the type of mirrors that we had in mind, 10 by 10 by 10 microns, or 20 by 20 something. We need about 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 round trips in a cavity of this length and a mechanical frequency of a few kilohertz. Those are very difficult requirements. On top of that, we want to exclude the standard quantum decoherence. So if you have this mirror on this mechanical mode, because this mirror is fixed, there is coupling to the environment, and that coupling determines the quality factor of your mechanical mode. So we need to have mechanical quality factors, say, of 100,000 or higher. And initially, we thought this was going to be the biggest problem. But right now, there are systems that easily get to the million or 10 million quality factors. So we see if we can get to the ground state and then start looking, we shouldn't have to worry too much about the traditional environment-induced quantum decoherence, because the isolation of these systems is quite good. Of course, we don't want collisions with background particles, because that would ruin the experiment directly. But since you do these experiments at very low temperatures, you get extremely high vacuum. The hardest part at the moment seems to be the stability, because you have cooling systems and so forth, and you still have your floppy resonator with a mirror, and you need to have very good stability. So what did we do? We started out working on this. And initial work, we took atomic force microscopes, cut out mirrors with some focused ion beam, glued them on top of that, and actually got some nice mechanical quality factors, but not so good optical properties. And we have to go to low temperatures. And to reach the low temperatures, we applied an optical cooling method. So we could go from room temperature to about 100 millikelvin. So once we were able to do that, I needed to do the same experiment, but starting from low temperatures, because we have to go to sub-microkelvins. And Giorgio Frossati at the University of Leiden, he's a world expert on really low temperature physics with low vibrations. So I teamed up with him. Here's some picture where we see Roger Penrose and Diozzi. This is the thing that goes inside the cryostat. This is Giorgio Frossati. We're installing here an adiabatic nuclear demagnetization stage. This is the final cooling step, where you apply a 10 Tesla magnetic field while everything is cold, already cold by dilution refrigeration, to say 20 millikelvin. Then, by slowly reducing the magnetic field, you get what is called entropy cooling. The nuclear spins start reorienting, and by that, the temperature goes down. And that we tested, and we got basically down to 100 microkelvin starting from 33 millikelvin. So the cooling power, everything is in place. And damping, we decided to take a two-step eddy current damping, so that's a high-quality copper with a ring of magnets. So if there's some motion, then there will be little currents induced in the metal plates, and that will damp the motion. And we had to have a development in the quality of the mirrors. And so from this bulky thing, we went to very nice small mirrors on silicon nitride arms. But there are many variations on this, and this is actually a problem. We are improving on a monthly basis, and there are people here in the audience that spent almost their entire PhD on trying to make these things better and better. And we're really getting, on some structures, we got very good mechanical cues. On some structures, we got very good optical cues. And we should be able to combine them. Now, in Leiden, there's this big effort to make this insert that will be cooled down. Initially, we have to have an optical cavity. But this optical cavity has to be aligned when it's cooled down. Everything is moving and doing. So we need about 8 controllers that work at millikelvin. And the commercial systems, attitude systems, turned out to be completely hopeless. They are not stable enough. So we had to develop our own motors together with a company. And they are now working properly. And by now, all the competitors are using the same product. So this was a big effort, but it's very important because these translation systems are based on piezos, and these always produce a little bit of noise just from intrinsic. And these motors are also used by piezos, but the piezos turn the knob. And then once they're off, these knobs are really fixed in place. So that was an important step. Okay, so some of the main players here. This is a fairly recent picture where you see here some of the damping states, one below, one above, one below. The nuclear state is not in here. In here we have this small mirror that the students at UCSB make, and they help doing the experiments in Leiden. Here are these new motors. And I don't think I have time to explain optical cooling, but it's very, there's different schemes. But one way is very similar to atomic cooling. If you have a resonance of your cavity and you have a high quality cavity, then the mechanical frequency might be outside your resonance, say at this point. And then if you put a laser beam at this frequency, then you have a very large probability of scattering this photon into the main cavity mode by absorbing a phonon. And the process the other way, where you emit a phonon, is far less likely because there's not a cavity mode. So you have an enhanced scattering into the cavity mode, and every time that happens, you pump out a photon of your system. So you really pump the mode you're interested to a lower phonon number. So remember, you have to have the environment at a low phonon number or at a low temperature, but your actual mechanical mode you want to get close to the quantum ground state. So what you expect from the optical cooling is that if your frequency will shift, there is an optical spring from the radiation pressure, and because of the delay, there's also a velocity-dependent damping, and you get a widening of the curves. So these are things we saw in 2010. We start here. There is an issue that our initial temperature is 800 millikelvin and not 1 millikelvin, where we'd like to start. But we see the broadening and the shifting, and we also see a lot of extra things happening here, which we now know it's based on laser noise that is also acting into the optomechanics, and we know how to get rid of this. But here we estimated that we are around 150 phonons, and a bit more recently we've got curves like this where we are roughly at the 10 phonons in the mechanical system. But now in this particular structure we see other modes coming up beside the main mode that we only see once you're at very low noise levels and very high sensitivity readout. So that's, we have ideas where it's coming from and how to help that. They form nice avoided crossings, so they're really mechanical modes on the structure. And I think I should wrap it up. We have more ideas on how to do this. I want to finish with saying that initially we thought we were the only crazy persons trying to do this. But in fact, I had a visitor, Marcus Aspelmeier, for some time. And this year, there was a student here, Jack Harris, a student of David Echelon, who was keen in this experiment. So Jack Harris got a position at Yale and went to work on this. Marcus Aspelmeier started working on this. And before I knew it, there were many people. This is actually the LIGO people got interested. This is, there are beautiful experiments on whispering gallery modes by Gary Vahala and one of his students, Ippenberg. He started looking at the coupling of the optical modes to mechanical modes of these structures, and he did spectacular work on that. Jack Harris used a membrane in the middle. Then the structures got smaller and smaller so that you don't have to go to these very low temperatures if the frequencies go up and up. Of course, you go away from where Penrose wants to be, but it's in itself very interesting. So you get these photonic structure lights where you get coupling of mechanical modes with optical modes. Then not optical, but or microwaves coupled to piezo modes. That was this work by Andrew Cleland that appeared, where it's actually a sort of expanding mode. They're tiny displacements, so from Penrose's point of view, this is not the thing to do, but it got the stamp as the first macroscopic quantum superposition. There are many criteria that you can come up with for macroscopic quantum superpositions, and for example, Tony Leggett has very different requirements than Roger Penrose. What for Tony Leggett seems to be a large macroscopic superposition, like currents going in counterclockwise directions in superconducting qubits, he says he basically count the number of particles that are involved, and that's a huge amount of electron or Cooper pairs moving around. But from Penrose's point of view, it's a uniform mass distribution. You compare it with the same uniform mass distribution, so it's not a macroscopic superposition at all. So there are different ways of looking at that, and all is open. The newest players are people with both Einstein condensates, putting them in large superpositions. The Marcus Arndt group that started with these buckyballs, they're now looking at significant size metal clusters that they try to get through interferometers. So I think it's pretty safe to say that we will test probably in 10 years from now whether we should buy this watch of Lev Veitman or whether other effects on decoherence should be considered. And Penrose doesn't have a theory for it, but maybe other theories should come up. So it's not quite a discussion talk, but this is all I wanted to say. Yeah? So any questions? And I should say that more and more, all these efforts are getting geared towards quantum information science, because a mechanical system is an ideal transducer from whatever structure you have, whether it's a superconducting qubit or a nitrogen vacancy or whatever. You can always couple it somehow to a mechanical mode by magnetic fields or some other, and then on the other side you couple it to your other system. So as transducers, mechanical systems are very, very interesting. Yes.
Is there any kind of what I might call smoking gun in the sense of a scaling law that would say that we distinguish this kind of collapse or decoherence mechanism from anything else that you would say?
Yes, very much so. This calculation, if you take the mass distribution to be a sphere to start with, then this calculation that Penrose does, half of the effect is if you have separated them by the diameter, and then if you go off to infinite, it will be the other half. It just can maybe become twice as large. Whereas all the other models have a very different dependence on the distance between the objects. So I think it's.
So it's a scaling with the separation.
It's a scaling with the separation that would be quite.
Immature of this mechanism, or at least ruling out some other mechanisms.
Yes. Yeah.
One other thing is the absence of scaling with temperature. If you saw scaling with temperature, that would be an indication.
That's right. Right.
You didn't see it.
This is a complete temperature independent argument here.
Thank you. Can I ask, you sort of hinted that some of these high frequency optomechanical membrane structures may not meet this criteria for macroscopic displacement. I wonder if you could elucidate that a little and say why that would be the case. Certainly they'll be in a number of superposition of orthogonal modes, for instance. But your claim is that there needs to be a displacement that's larger than the maximum physical size of the structure in order for this effect to...
The displacement is one of the things that I try to argue is not quite clear how much you have to displace, whether it's the size of the nucleus or whether it's the size of quantum ground state of the system. You could argue it's the size of the quantum ground state, because if something is displaced by the size of the quantum ground state, it's in a distinguishable state. You can, by addition, other measurements, you can say that it's in a different state. So that's enough to entangle it with the photon. So that should reduce completely the visibility of your photon if you're displaced by the quantum ground state. So that's a safe distance by which this effect should take place. Whether the size of the nucleus is acceptable is not clear.
Okay, but in these structures, as within other things like optical bonons, for example, the displacements will be on the order of the size of the nucleus, but not large, and yet they will be in orthogonal states, and that will be adequate to be able to tell that you've got an entanglement, but not adequate, I understand, to meet this criteria that you're suggesting for.
No, I think that would already be adequate. There are other people who really want to see larger displacements, and that's why if such experiments could be done out in space with very long delay lines, you can just, if you have given it a kick, you can just wait longer and see.
So if I were to pursue that line slightly further and go from your macroscopic mirrors down to these nano beam vibrations and go yet a step further into optical phonons as material, what point would you say that?
Well, how will you put it in a superposition? Because the idea of the mirror, a very light mirror at a low frequency, the bouncing of a photon is sufficient to put it in a different state.
Sure, but straightforwardly, I simply use Raman scattering and detect my single Stokes photon, and then I've got a single photon in my material. I can do that across several different physically well-separated samples and generate such a state.
If you think you can get an entanglement with a distinguished state by some other measurement, then that should work. That should work. So the reason why this field is so expanding is that almost everyone can use his particular PET system to do this. Jeff Kimball is working on this, Eugen Poljik, Charlie Marcus. There are many, many people who now try to start looking at the quantum states of mechanical systems. And it's the next family member in the quantum zoo, I would say. And this argument for Penrose is just a minute part that might be nice if it comes along. Yeah.
So coming back to the argument for Penrose.
Yes, I would like to learn more about that.
A lot of ad hoc in this point. So the thing, the order of magnitude of the effect is based on the energy.
Yes.
Which is delta rho over x minus 1.
Yes.
Is there a relativistic version of that? That's a highly non-relativistic.
Yeah, it's a pure classical argument.
No. Yeah. But it's also non-relativistic.
Yeah.
It's non-local. So what is it? Is there a version of that? I mean, Penrose. If you would be obligated to give at least a special relativistic being very informed of that, if not a general relativistic
There is, I think, Joy Christensen. There is someone who has done this, and I think the result is that it almost stays the same. The estimate
for these systems.
For these systems.
Is it one of the
I honestly don't know enough to say that. But I have a question for you. I'm personally quite.
What bothers me, aside from everything else,
sure,
is that linear dependence on the cutoff, on the UV cutoff, one over A effect. The reason you get something that you can measure is that A is small.
Would this correspond to some kind of time scale? Like, you know, typically if you have a decoherence mechanism, like there is a for a real buff, there is a, for example, some kind of memory time, right, for Markovian buff, it's very short.
Yes.
So would there be some kind of, like, a characteristic time of the.
So very, very naive, you could say, if you have a superposition of mass, you basically create a blister in space-time. There are two different space-time structures, and that statement only makes sense if you have some sort of reference system, your experimental apparatus around it. Then with respect to that frame, you could say if the mass is here, mass there, you should have two different space-time structures, and to go from one to the other would require a certain amount of energy, and that amount of energy is the same energy as you calculate here. And if you create a superposition, you would, that's what Penrose argues, and that's the most dubious part, he says you would need this extra bit of energy to do this. And then he says, okay, quantum mechanically is fine to have a certain extra amount of energy needed, but then you have delta E delta T, and that will then give you the time for which it's allowed. Delta E delta T is of the order of h bar. That will give you the time. That will give you delta.
That's delta.
That's the time.
What I'm asking about is whether, you know, something of the kind Derek mentioned would actually imply some kind of correlation time for this. I mean, this is like a decoherence term, right? You know,
yeah.
Any kind of decoherence term usually has some correlation time. Things are not Markovian, things are only approximation, right?
But then you think of standard two-level systems interacting where you have lifetimes and coherence times. But here there is no level system there, and the language is not in terms of coherence times.
In your case, it's fast. It doesn't matter. You just want to see that.
Yeah, but the fastness should be some number, right? You know.
So there's an energy, so there's super. Yeah.
That's it. That's all there is to the argument.
Energy is not a correlation. It's something else. I mean, it is.
In the superposition of two masses, the superposition is the lowest energy state, no? If they can mix, they'll mix it. The mass on one side is an excited state, which will eventually decay.
That means that this Markovian thing is only an approximation to something which is more. Albert Leggett is not, you know, does not give you just Markovian decay, right? That's some other features.
Yeah, I think that's the type of thing that Philip Stemp is trying to calculate, or he is with Bill Underwood. They've been looking into that. But my question is, all these things really, really started from this conformal symmetry. And how important would you say is conformal symmetry in elementary physics or in fundamental physics?
It's very fundamental, but it's broken.
It's broken, but is it broken from the very beginning? Or
what does that mean?
Can we start with a conformal invariant theory?
Penrose's Twister story, which is gave us motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And parenthetically, even long-headed ideas can give rise to marvelous stimulus, beautiful experiments.
Yeah, that's why we do this experiment anyway. That's
gorgeous. But the has actually had a revival.
I know there was this big KTP conference recently, but then they went off in scattering calculations and things.
Just for general information, the Twister theory, which became somewhat of a cult in Oxford. For years, and none of the guys who pursued it could get a job.
Except for in Oxford, yes.
And the last decade has, you know, revived enormously with application to non-abelian in the QCD, of course, supersymmetric QCD, which is quantum mechanic is a non-linear. Complicated theory and is conformally invariant. Whereas if you take a theory like electrodynamics, which Penrose concentrated on back then, once you turn on H bar, it is not conformally invariant. Period. There are quantum anomalies about conformal scale invariance. It's broken. It's actually, there are very few classes of theories, theories that are exactly conformally invariant and to which these Twister ideas can be used. Those, of course, are very interesting ones, much more interesting than, say, QED. They've been exploited enormously. Supersymmetric. Formally invariant theories turn out to be in the limit where the number of colors, number of charges gets big, become integral. They have infinite number of conservation laws and can be solved exactly. And the Twister ideas play a big role in that. And all those people who hung around Oxford, and Roger for so many years, some of them now have gotten jobs.
Yeah, so the thing that we looked into, I was a postdoc with Roger Penrose a long time ago, just I got some fellowship before doing quantum optics experiments. I've always been intrigued about these Robinson congruences of null geodesics. And there was a different group that came up with light solutions that looked very similar, and so we have now proven that there are simple elementary states in twister theory that give you precisely these solutions. But once you have these elementary states, you can apply them to other fields very easily within that formalism. So we just submitted a little article on linked gravitational field configuration. So it's so pretty what comes out of there that there must be some truth in it, but the truth might be if you go to quantum chromodynamic, you say.
Well, I mean, the conformal, I mean, that could all work. So the original approach was dealing with, was to try to deal with Einstein's theory, where it hasn't been that useful.
Yeah.
Quantum effects tend to break conformal.
And this whole idea to actually see space-time as some secondary object, because if you go to this...
There are people who open these papers and they, since you can solve this quantum field theory exactly now in this limit and recover, you know, you do it all in this twister or corresponding language, space-time never appears. It's
right, right.
It's emerging, but
yeah, okay.
All right. Not clear how far that'll go. Yeah. But what it has to do with the implications for the, you know, cyclic universes and the second law of thermodynamics, the arrow of time, well, and therefore the reduction of phase space. And, you know, that's a long way.
But what is the standard argument, which I don't know, on the entropy? Because the cosmic background radiation shows that there is this beautiful...
gravity is negative 6 heat, so that's, we all know that gravity provides an ever-increasing source of...
Yes, okay, but then it's gravity that produces entropy and thereby time, I would say.
Well, it produces an arrow of time.
Yes, yes, it breaks the symmetry in time.
Arrow of time.
Yes, yes.
You know, without an hour of time, you can have time, like we have in most of physics.
Well, it would be symmetric in future and.
Is it true of the laws of physics?
Not of the laws of life.
But the laws of thermodynamics.
Yes, yes. So an atom is perfectly time symmetric, sure. Yeah.
Everything you know is time.
Yes, except for everything that matters. Okay.
It's true. So usually you say there's a special initial, you know, initial state that you know nothing about,
and there's no and if.
And it's got a long way to go because it will end up in black hole.
Yeah, and but you say even after the evaporation, entropy still keeps increasing. There's no
after what?
After evaporation of the black holes, the entropy just keeps increasing. Because it goes into low frequency radiation.
It depends on the global structure of the universe.
It keeps expanding.
It's in space, which has accelerated expansion. Because what's in your causal, in your horizon, gets fewer and fewer of the laser frequency.
All right.
Are there
questions about the experiment?
The end of the universe about which we know nothing.
Well, but maybe it's not so difficult to know something about it. I think Penrose always dares to say that maybe there are simple answers even for those very difficult questions. But that's, yeah. Any experimental questions?
Yeah, I have a question.
It's a hard experiment as well.
So when do you think you'll get there?
Let's say, when do I think the collective effort will get there? Because
when do you think your approach
this particular approach? I can only say what our major problem is at the moment is that this cavity is constantly moving. So to do the optical cooling, you have to be on the edge of a resonance. So you must able to follow this resonance. So what we typically do now is we take two lasers, one that is on one edge of a fiery pro fringe, and then another laser that we do the cooling. So they have to follow all the drift of the cavity. And that sets the intensity of the tracking laser. And that tracking laser will heat up, by some absorption of the photons, will heat up the structure. So that is why some of the initial temperatures were 800 millikelvin and not 1 millikelvin that we could reach, because we have too much optical power in there. In principle, we wouldn't need it if there wouldn't be this constant motion. And that's, I just cannot, what we've done now is to go to complete different designs where everything is on a chip and the mechanical resonator is built into a vacuum cavity in the chip, and this whole thing can be mounted in a complete different way and it's all self-aligned. But there's another student here that's just started this PhD project on that. So I think we must get lucky, and we should get to the ground state on a quiet Sunday night. Because all those measurements that I showed, they can only be done in the middle of the night. That's already, if anyone walking in the building, and that this setup has its own 30-meter post into the ground. And they're actually building right now a new building. There are a few people who are interested in these things, and there will be even more emphasis on a very stable initial structure. But there's this thing that the U.S. government has taken a claim on all the helium resources. That means that everyone is now using pulse tube coolers, which is a hammer stamping on your setup to compress and expand your helium and by that cooling. And we simply cannot afford running this system anymore because it's just horribly expensive to cool this thing down. So we have a second system now in the make, but that's with this hammer on top of it. And I'm not sure how long it will take to fight that. But as a collective effort with all these different systems, there are very, very interesting progress in very different directions. So I think the concept of large objects in superpositions, that is definitely going to happen in the coming 10 years. It will definitely be able to rule out the type of measurements that Penrose produces or other people. It will never prove them, I'm sure. Yeah. All right.
I think we should.
It's enough for now.
And Jared is still there.
Jared's
so
still
much.
There?
Oh, I'm missing Jared. Thank you so much. And Jared, thank you. This was very kind of you to do this, and we all learned a lot. So
thank you.